one other sick person that I did not get in the bulletin, nor did I mention it to Brother Eccles, but one who should be mentioned is Howard Kennedy. Howard has not been well at all for some time. Of course, he's really not been well for some years since he's been here. And the fact that he has rather often been unable to be present with us may have kept some of us from getting as closely acquainted with him as we might. But I believe that Howard is, I know that Howard is very dedicated and desires to be with us, but his condition is such that he just is not able to be here much of the time, and that has particularly been true in the past few weeks. And we need to remember Howard with our prayers and calls, and an occasional visit would mean a great deal to him, particularly during the day when he is often at home alone. You'll be blessed yourself by going by to see Howard as you have opportunity to do. One of the facts that we understand is that an army demands men. And we know also, I suppose, that the church is an army. And that means that the church needs men. Men do not just happen. Men to serve effectively in the army do not just happen. They have to be trained. Men who would serve effectively in the church of the Lord do not just happen. They have to be trained. We who are parents of young sons today are training the Lord's army for tomorrow. Consequently, it is certainly true, though it has been said again and again, it must not lose its meaning simply because of repetition, that the church of tomorrow lies within our hands. But even more than that, I think each one of us would be impressed by the fact that the destiny of each soldier lies within our hands. To some considerable degree, though this is not the only factor, yet to a great degree, what our sons will be determined by what we train them to be. Where they will spend eternity will be determined by the kind of influence that we wield upon them, the kind of instruction and training we give them. We have an unusual and good number of fine young men in this congregation. One of the things that impressed me about this past week is the number of young men who are preaching the gospel, young men of intellectual ability, young men who know what is going on in the world, young men who have dedicated themselves to the Lord's work and are diligently set for the defense of the gospel. But really, this does not relieve us of responsibility, for it is our responsibility as parents to take care and to train and develop the son that we have in our care, just as it is the responsibility of this congregation to develop the young men that are among us. The fact that we do have sons, and that we have intelligent sons, and good-looking sons, just means that the responsibility is all the greater upon us to see to it that they are trained for the Lord. So Bob Tootin asked a question here on Thursday afternoon. How many evangelists has this church sent forth, not simply with money, but with training? How many of our young men have planned to preach the gospel and are willing to go into needy, destitute places? This is a question that every congregation must ask and answer, and a question that each of us as parents must ask and answer. Ed Harrell on Thursday night, emphasize the fact that training to be a Christian soldier is not an easy thing. Training to be any kind of soldier is not easy. It is strenuous, just as training to be an effective football player or a good basketball player, even baseball player, is a strenuous training. There must be those rules of early to bed, of no smoking, no drinking, no exercise of any kind that is harmful and detrimental. But on the other hand, that discipline that is required by strenuous physical exercise that is properly supervised and properly planned, sweat, shortness of breath, aching muscles, this all goes with becoming a good athlete. Consequently, it should not be surprising that self-control is essential to become a soldier of the cross. There are some things that one cannot engage in. There's some things that we cannot do, places we cannot go, people we cannot associate with, if we're going to be good Christians. And it requires of us that we set our goal, that we press on toward that goal regardless of the problems that may come in our way. And so if we suggest some things this morning that are not altogether pleasant, we suggest some rules, we would really, maybe at this present point of development, prefer to accept. Yet at the same time, remember that such things are necessary in order to achieve any kind of worthwhile goal. Of necessity, this lesson this morning must be rather sketchy. And I'm hoping that we can simply suggest some important principles that parents must remember in the training and development of sons to be men of God. I'm going to suggest five briefly, but think of them and develop them farther in your subsequent thinking. The first thing I want to bring to your attention is the fact that religion is for men. Solomon said this in the third chapter of Proverbs when he was training his own son. We should remember that the book of Proverbs is written as a father's instructions to his son. Beginning with verse 1, he said, "My son, forget not my law, but let thine heart keep my commandments. For length of days and long life and peace shall they add to thee. Let not mercy and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck, write them upon the table of thy heart. So shalt thou find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man." Now to his son he says, "Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not in thine understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. Be not wise in thine own eyes. Fear the Lord, and depart from evil. It shall be health to thy navel and marrow to thy bones. Honor the Lord with thy substance and with the first fruits of thine increase. So shall thy barns be filled with plenty. Thy wine presses shall burst with new wine. My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, neither be weary of his correction. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and as a father, the son in whom he delighted." In the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 13, in teaching Christians that they should be strong, he said, "Watch ye, stand fast, quit ye like men." The word quit there meaning to stand, to be firm, like men are firm. Religion requires manliness and strength. Ephesians 6, 10, "Be strong in the Lord, and in the power of his might, put on the whole armor of God, that you may withstand the wiles of the devil." Paul wrote to a young man in 1 Timothy 6:12, saying, "Fight the good fight, lay hold on eternal life." Being a Christian is a fight. It's a challenge to undertake, and it is not for sissies. You know, the devil has been a liar from the beginning. Jesus said that about him. The very first woman made was deceived by one of Satan's lies. Every woman and every man who's lived since that time has also, at some point or another, been deceived. And one of the devil's favorite lies is to suggest that a thing is silly, which in reality demands the greatest courage that any person will ever have to exert. If a person is taken as prisoner of war, which is silly and which requires courage? Is it courageous to give in and say, all right, I'll do what you as an enemy want me to do. I'll submit to the pressure. I'll do what you're demanding. Is that courageous? Or we understand that that's the sissy thing, or that's the weak thing. And I do not judge others having not been in that position, but we would say that that's the weak thing, certainly in contrast with the courageous thing. And yet here's a boy with a group of companions. They're trying to get him to take a drink, a thing he knows is wrong. Or they're trying to get him to drop acid or smoke a reefer. They're trying to get him to join in with their cursing or to go with them to some place that they know is wrong and that he knows is wrong. And when he refuses to go with them or refuses to do it with them or refuses to curse with them, what do they say? They say, you're a sissy. In reality, it takes courage to refuse to do what others are trying to get us to do. The weakling, the sissy, is the one who submits to the pressure and does what he doesn't really want to do. That's the sissy. That's the weakling. But somehow we have convinced ourselves that it is the other way around. It takes courage for a boy to stand up and lead a song or make a talk or pray, especially when there are those who are inclined to laugh at him, those who are inclined to ridicule. It takes courage. It's the sissy, it's the weakling who sits back and will not do it, fearful that there will be criticism or ridicule. John Mark was one who became weak on occasion and turned back after having started out to serve the Lord. Was that strength on his part? Was it courage? No. He did not become courageous until he reversed his course and was willing to stand and willing to be firm regardless of the consequences. There are young men who through the centuries have stood faithful and firm to the Lord. The Apostle John wrote to some such young men in 1 John, the 2nd chapter, where he said that he had written to young men because they were strong and had overcome the evil one. It takes strength to do that. And it takes strength in men as well as in women. And the idea that religion is for women is just the favorite lie of the devil. But it is a lie. We must train our young men to recognize it. We must commend them when they have the courage and the strength to stand for what's right against the pressures that they must face. And we must make it clear to them that when they give in, they actually are walking the course of weakness. But a second thing that I believe we need to train our sons to recognize is that men must be pure as well as women. Somehow there has been the prevalent idea that in the relationship between men and women that a man has the right to do whatever a woman will let him do in his relationship with her. That it is altogether the responsibility of the woman to call a halt if the man gets out of line. And if she doesn't call a halt, why then the man is free of guilt, free of responsibility. And there is many a man who grows angry with his wife when she takes the very kind of liberties that he himself takes all the time. Or their boys are indignant when their sister is mistreated, all the while they themselves are mistreating somebody else's sister. This is a false idea, an idea that makes no sense whatever. And if a boy comes up thinking that women are going to have to call a halt, and that he is free and it's the manly thing simply to do whatever a woman may let him do, then he is headed for an immoral life in this immoral age in which we live. man said to me the other day, why do you talk so much about the way women ought to live, and the way women ought to dress, and the way women ought to talk? He said that you talk like women are worse than men. That's not it exactly. At all. It's not it at all. But the point is that men are not going to rise above what women are. They never have, and they never will. Women have tended to hold men above a certain level of the animal kingdom. But in our time, women have tended to turn away from those higher standards that they used to maintain. And men are ahead of them in going down, down, down without the restraining influence of good womanhood. But the man has responsibility to be pure as well as the woman, and the young man as well as the older man. Paul wrote to the young man Timothy in 1 Timothy 5:22, saying, keep thyself pure. Oh, but we say young men have impulses and desires that are just too strong for them. This is not true. God has not made any man with stronger desires and appetites than can be controlled. Several times during the past week, reference was made to the promise of 1 Corinthians 10:13 that God will not permit us to be tempted above that which we're able to bear. That goes for young men as well as old men. Paul wrote to Timothy acknowledging that there are youthful lusts. But he didn't say because you're young and have youthful lusts, you just have to give in to them, and later on you can learn to control them. Rather, he wrote, flee also youthful lusts. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 22. Struggle with them, fight with them, recognize you have an enemy, and rise to the challenge and put him down. I still believe that there are young men who are pure. I think we have some right here in this congregation who are just as moral and just as pure in their conduct and in their lives as young men have ever been. It is possible. When we give in to temptation, using as excuse the times we're living in or the companions we have or the fact that we're young, we're simply giving in and finding some excuse for giving in. It's not necessary to give in. It is possible to stand firm and to do right. One day my son will want a virtuous, pure wife. He has every reason to bring to her a virtuous and pure husband so that there may be purity from the very beginning of the marriage, not only in the wife, but also in the husband. And a woman has every bit as much right to expect a pure husband, one who has kept himself pure through his early life, as a young man has to expect a pure wife who has kept herself pure through her early life. But we hasten on to point out the third thing, and these are so closely related they can hardly be separated. The purity demands care in the choice of companions. If there is any one thing that I believe must be controlled if a young man is to be pure, it is his companion. But he can control that, and that's the point. When we say, oh, our desires are so great and our temptations are so great, we just can't resist. Well, that may be true if we choose the kind of companions that will surround us with such temptations. If we go to such places or feed our minds on such things, that our lusts and desires are stirred to the very maximum peak, it may be that we come to the point where we cannot resist temptation. But the young man who really wants to be pure is going to control the things he sees. He's going to control the places he goes. And he's going to be concerned with the kind of companions that he has. And if he is concerned about those things, then temptation will not overcome him. He'll not reach the point where he cannot resist. This book of Proverbs is a wonderful book. Though it's in the Old Testament, it has the kind of instructions that a father gives to his son that are absolutely ageless. They apply in every generation. Look with me back to the fourth chapter of Proverbs and verse 14, where the wise man says, enter not into the path of the wicked, and go not in the way of evil men. Avoid it. Pass not by it. Turn from it, and pass away. For they sleep not, except they have done mischief. Their sleep is taken away, unless they come cause some to fall. Now, if you know of individuals who cannot sleep except they've done mischief, sleep is taken away unless they've caused someone to fall, then that's the kind of individual with whom you must not be associated. You must avoid any companionship with such people. In Proverbs 24 and verse 1, the wise man said, be not thou envious against evil men, neither desire to be with them. Neither desire to be with them. Because when you're with them, if you're not careful, you'll be among them. The first psalm begins, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. This is not the place for one who wants to do right to be. In 1 Corinthians 15:33, and we'll be back to Proverbs in a moment, the Apostle Paul says, evil companionships corrupt good morals. The King James says manners, but morals, I believe, is a better statement. Evil companionships corrupt good morals. You keep the right kind of people, you'll do right. You get with the wrong kind of people, and unless you're careful, exceedingly careful, you'll be doing wrong. We say, oh, but I'm strong enough. I can go with any kind of people and do right. I'd remind you then of 1 Corinthians 10:12, let him that thinketh he stand take heed lest he fall. If the Apostle Peter could not resist the temptation to deny Jesus because he was surrounded by those who were Jesus' enemies, I need not think that I can resist temptation in my weakness. I need simply to stay out of such company, if at all possible. Back in Proverbs, the second chapter, the wise man speaks not only of male companionship for his son, but also of female companionship. When wisdom entereth into thine heart, beginning with verse 10, Proverbs 2:10, and knowledge is pleasant unto thy soul, discretion shall preserve thee, understanding shall keep thee, to deliver thee from the way of evil men. In other words, if you have discretion and wisdom, knowledge, these will keep you from the way of evil men, from the man that speaketh forward things, who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice to do evil and delight in the forwardness of the wicked, whose ways are crooked and they forward in their path, to deliver thee from the strange woman. Wisdom and discernment will deliver you both from the wicked man and from the strange woman, even from the stranger which flattereth with her words, which forsaketh the guide of her youth, and forgetteth the covenant of her God. For her house inclineth to death, and her paths unto the dead. When a woman begins to demonstrate by her manner of speech, by her appearance, by her conduct, that she is not the right kind of woman, then it's time for a Christian man and one who wants to be pure to go in the opposite direction, to say, this is the end, I'll have nothing to do with her. Of course, such a woman has a fascination for a man. Really, this term strange suggests with it the idea of fascination. There is a worldly the characteristic of men that find some fascination in that kind of woman. But when you begin to see by her language, by her appearance, by her conduct, that she is not pure, that she's not a good woman, it's time then for a man, young or old, to make tracks and get out of the way. For as the wise man said, her house inclineth unto death, and her paths unto the dead. Spiritually, and possibly even physically, death can result from association with such a woman. I want to teach my son, rather than being fascinated with that kind of woman, to seek a wife who is beautiful in the sight of God. We talked last week about the things that God values in a woman, the things that are beautiful in the sight of God. And I want to teach my son somehow to see things through God's eyes and realize that true character is beauty, and the only beauty that will last. A woman who is loved simply for the beauty of her face or the beauty of her form, eventually will you lose that. That will not last forever. It will not last more than a few years. When that beauty of face and form is gone, what's going to be left? What will remain? If that's all she had, there'll be nothing remaining. But if there is internal beauty, if there is character there, then in fact, as the physical form fades, that internal beauty becomes more beautiful. Paul said, though the outward man perish, yet the inner man is renewed day by day. And in reality, that inner character will give beauty even to the aged woman, which cannot possibly be attained by the woman whose life is filled with evil. There's a difference in an aged, godly woman in the beauty of her face and in the face of a woman who has been hardened by sin and by immorality. And you know that that is so. Remember again the statement of 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 3 and 4. You wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by the conversation of their wives, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear, whose adorning, let it not be the outward adorning of plaiting the hair and of wearing of gold and of putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. That's the kind of woman my son needs for a wife. If he marries that kind of woman, or she may not be the most popular in the school. She may not be praised and honored by the worldly men around her, but she'll make him a good wife. She'll be a blessing to him all his days, long after the bell of the ball has proved to be a bomb. Long after that good woman whom he has respected for her character will be a wife who will be a blessing to him. This most certainly is true. And we all seem, I think, know that it's true down deep in our hearts. But it's so easy for us to be influenced and to be moved by the crowds that surround us and by the thinking of other people. These are the things that we allow to govern and to control our thinking. And let me just say this right now to young ladies, though I spoke to them last week particularly, I want to come to this this morning. You may not, if you may emphasize in your life this beauty of character, the development of this ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, you may not immediately find a husband. You may think that boys are just not looking for this kind of thing these days. You know, that's true. The majority of boys are not looking for this kind of thing these days. But the majority of boys make sorry husbands. I might hark back to some things Brother Harold said. The majority of boys today would make sorry husbands. They don't have any morals, the majority. They don't really have any concern for purity in their own life. The majority of boys will make sorry husbands. But there are still a few good boys. Don't you doubt that for a minute. Really, there are many from one point of view, maybe in comparison to you, but there are still many good boys who more than any other thing want a good, godly, consecrated, holy, devout, pure wife. That's what they want. Your path will cross one of these days if you just hold out and not compromise. not give in. Ora. When you find the boy that's looking for the kind of pure godly girl that you have kept yourself to be, you'll find the boy that'll make you a good husband, the kind you can depend on to love you and to be faithful to you in sickness and in health, in prosperity and in adversity, one who will keep himself to you and to you alone as long as you both shall live. The boys need to remember that with reference to the girls. Don't give up and decide that there are no pure, godly girls. There are some. There are some. Keep watching. Keep looking. Keep listening. You'll find one. Not at a dance. That's where, not where you find that kind. Not in some immoral place of entertainment. That's not where you find that kind. You'll find them at services. You'll find them at gospel meetings. Not necessarily where you worship, but maybe across town somewhere. If that's the kind of places you find that kind of girl, they're around. Don't you doubt it for a minute. Fourth, boys must be taught God's standard of greatness. We mentioned this last week with reference to girls, but it's true also of boys. Maybe there's been no time in history when this was more needed. I'm sure there have been many times when this was as much needed. The whole desire of the masses of our youth today seems to be to get as much as possible while giving as little as possible. The earlier we can retire, the happier we are. But we no longer have to accept the responsibilities of labor. Work is a thing to be avoided. Leisure, a thing to be desired. You know, Jesus taught exactly the opposite of that. Jesus said in John 5:17, "My Father work and I work, even till now." Somebody said, "Didn't God rest?" Yes, God rested on the Sabbath day. That is, he ceased from the labor of building the world. God kept on working all through the ages. God labored. And in the fourth chapter of Ephesians, in verse 28, "Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing that is good, that he may retire early." No. "That he may not have to beg from somebody else." Well, that's all right. But the quote is given here is that he may give to him that needs. The reason for work, even for a Christian, is not simply to get what he needs, but to be able to give to others. It's not a matter of getting as much as possible while giving as little as possible, but it's rather getting as much as possible so you can give more than you've gotten. That's really the purpose, the point that is being made in this passage. And greatness is not to be measured in terms of position, whether you're a vice president or a president of the corporation, or whether you are a captain or a major or a colonel. Greatness is not determined by how much money you may be making or how many men there may be under you. Jesus said unto his disciples, "You know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them. They that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you, but whosoever shall be great among you, let him be your minister," servant, slave, some translations say. "And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant, your slave." Would you be great in this congregation? Serve. Would you be great in your community? Seek greatness through service. Not by being praised because of your service, but simply by the joy of serving, knowing that you're doing something that is worthwhile for somebody. And of course, the most important service you can render is the service that is rendered to God and to render to others in behalf of God. I want, therefore, to teach my son to give rather than to get. I want to teach him to be more concerned with tiring than retiring. And I want to teach him that work is honorable and that to serve is the real goal in life. I want to teach him that the greatest service is spiritual service. Romans 12:1. I beseech you, therefore, by the mercies of God, that you give your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is, as the American Standard says, your spiritual service. And I want to teach him that the greatest profit, in fact, the only real profit of all, is the profit of godliness. This is what the Apostle Paul teaches in 1 Timothy 4:7-8. Exercise thyself rather unto godliness, for godliness is profitable unto all things, having the promise of the life that now is, and of that which is to come. But finally, in this brief lesson, I want to teach my son that it is easier to start bad habits than it is to break them. And on the other hand, to start good habits in youth is to make later life a far easier life to live. I cut this out of a magazine, I don't know how many years ago. I guess I could figure it up, but I think I'd rather not. A newspaper rather than a magazine. It struck me, and though I've lost an awful lot of things through the years, this is one thing I haven't lost. There's a picture of a little sheep. I don't know, there's something about a little fellow's sheep that is always rather intriguing to me. I see people that have shoes bronzed, and there they are. Sometimes I go plowing through an old barrel or drum in which we've kept things for some years, and there I find a little brown shoe, worn, and somehow you can't forget that shoe. And I'll ask my wife, whose shoe was this? She always knows. I don't know. But she knows to which one of the children this little shoe belonged. Right, there's a little shoe, and it catches your eye. You couldn't miss. And it is with a companion the same shape as the shoe. These words: the foot that fits this shoe can't fill yours, but it will try to follow in your footsteps. The very thought makes a responsible father walk a resolute path, bringing sense and good judgment to every step he takes, including moderation in his use of the products we sell, the House of Seagram. That's not what I want to teach my son. If I teach him moderation in the use of the products that the House of Seagram sells, he may abide by that for a time. But how many who have started out in moderation have gone on to alcoholism? Why be moderate in a thing that's destructive? Destructive of character, destructive of health, destructive of finances, destructive of everything that's worth anything in life. Why even be moderate in it? Why not completely abstain? That's what I have tried to teach my son and shall continue to teach him. Don't touch it. Run from it. It is dangerous to the ultimate degree. And if I'm going to teach him that, I'm going to have to show him that. The only way in the world I can teach him is to show him what it means to abstain. Not simply to abstain from bringing it into the home, but to abstain when I'm in a position where others are drinking, where others are insisting that I drink, where the pressure is great. I say no. When he knows that Dad doesn't, then he'll be inclined not to himself. But if someday he begins to drink, and someday allows whiskey to ruin his life, to destroy his family, to bring him to an early grave, and to cause his soul to be lost, he does that. God forbid that he should do it because he was following in his father's footsteps up to a point where he was not able to control himself. May God forbid that that be so. May he never, never take a drink because he is encouraged by the example of his daddy. What is true of liquor and drink is true of cursing and swearing. Oh, it's so hard to break the habit of cursing. I expect those of us who have been blessed by God with parents and other influences that have kept us from beginning it don't really realize how difficult it is to break that habit. When a boy has learned to curse and to swear, it's harder, I think, sometimes to break that habit than it is the habit of drink. I remember a few years ago trying to convert a man, who eventually was converted by God's power. But the man had been a very worldly man, and he began attending services, and I preached to him, and he seemed to be so interested, and it seemed each time we gave an invitation, I expected him to come, but he just didn't. And I was leaving the place where I'd lived. We'd been close friends, and I just hadn't been able to move him at all. And I just said, "What's holding? What's the problem?" And he finally broke down and said, "It's cursing." He said, "I just can't quit." I said, "You quit drinking, didn't you? Truck driver." He said, "Yeah, I quit drinking." He said, "Somehow it wasn't any problem. I quit." He said, "They kept trying to get me to drink, but I just couldn't quit. And I couldn't quit. Well, he said, "I quit the drinking. And in spite of all of their efforts to move me, I just didn't fall. I didn't break over." But he said, "It's cursing. I can't quit. I just can't." Eventually he did. But the point I'm making is that this is a habit that's extremely difficult to break. It doesn't have to be started. And this is one of the reasons I want to preach along this line to parents, and hope it'll spill over to our fine young people here. Don't ever start it. Keep your lips. Keep control of them. You don't ever lose control. Well, then you'll never have the problem of regaining control. There's no reason why you ought to use the name of God lightly, profanely. God, who's been so good to you and done so much for you, why drag him into it when you get angry or when you don't like something or don't like somebody? Why bring the God of heaven into your brawl or into your anger or into your unhappiness? God is too holy and too great to be brought into these earthly human things. We need to leave God out of them insofar as bringing his name in a profane way. Be careful of your speech. And I just can't help but suggest, too, that we need to teach our sons to avoid the habit of smoking. Oh, how many men I have seen who at the age of 50, 60, 70, look back over their life and realize the thousands and thousands of dollars they've spent on it. Realize the time they have spent with their cough and their weakness of body. They realize they have wasted themselves physically. They say, "I'd give anything in the world if I could stop, but a habit you've had for 50 years is hard to break." No question about that. I've seen some break it. Now, I wouldn't say one word to discourage anyone from undertaking it, regardless of how old you are or how long you have it. But I'll tell you, it's a whole lot easier never to start. I had a good father that warned me against such things, and I never smoked the first cigarette. Not bragging, I'm just saying I never smoked the first one. Not having smoked the first one, I never had any problem breaking the habit. I've gone through life with all of the ease in the world as far as smoking is concerned. I've had other problems. As far as smoking is concerned, it's never been a problem to break the habit because it just never got started. You're not proving yourself to be smart when you smoke. You're proving yourself to be foolish. You're not proving yourself to be courageous when you smoke. You're showing yourself to be weak. Don't start it. It won't do you any good. It'll do you an awful lot of harm. And I'll say this too. It would be hard for me to teach my son not to smoke if I was smoking. I don't see how in the world I could ever expect to ask him to give up anything that I was doing. Tell him he shouldn't do it. We're going to train our sons to be what they ought to be. We're going to have to say, follow me. I know we're not perfect as fathers, but if there's some area in which we can improve our lives, can take out things that are harmful, or put in things that are beneficial, then by all means, we need to do it. I hope my boy will be a better man than I am, but I want to do my best to lead him just as far as I can go. It'll be hard enough for him that way. But by God's grace, with the help God supplies, if I can teach him to walk hand in hand with God, then through God's help, he can not only be as good as I am, he can be a better man than I am. And go on perhaps to bring up a boy, a grandson for me, will be a better man even than he is. I don't believe there's any amount of sin in the world that can make it impossible to be a Christian. I just don't believe it. I don't believe there's any school that's so bad but that a boy can be a Christian in that school. In fact, I don't know. I have more or less had this. I'll quit preaching now. We're going to talk just a minute. You talk in the lobby out there a long time. Let me talk to you just a minute. I think, as I look back, that maybe I've made some mistakes in my assessment of things. I have thought in the past that by all means, my children needed to be in the place where they were surrounded by the most Christians and where everything would be the easiest for them to be Christians. Well, I just don't think we ought to lead our children into temptation. I don't think that. But as I've looked about in my experience and observed what I've observed, I just tell you, I'm not sure there's any correlation between a place where there are a lot of Christians and it's easy to be moral and real Christianity. In fact, sometimes it looks like to me I've seen stronger young people coming out of some of the dives of sin that really are what the schools of some parts of our country are. Someone said to me just the other day who had observed students down in Florida, at Florida College. They said I believe that the purest, best, most conscientious and diligent students, with the exceptions, but this is a rule, who are just morally refined, are probably coming from schools in the North. And generally, the students from Alabama, where the church is strong, from Tennessee, where the church is strong, tend to be more worldly. Isn't that so? This was a very objective, and actually it was from a person who is from Alabama. But this was the observation. They're coming from Akron, Ohio. Or they're coming from Louisville, Kentucky. Or they're coming from Indianapolis, Indiana, where they've got problems in the high school. But what is happening in most of those cases is that the high schools are so bad that the young people just know they can't have very much social life among the worldly people of those high schools. And so they tend to form companionships with Christians and to stand together and to find courage and strength in the association of one another. to resist the temptations that are all around us. No, there's not any school that's so wicked that you can't live a Christian life if you want to. There's not any city that is so immoral but that you can be a good Christian. There's not any office, to get away from our young people to those who are older, where you can't be a Christian. You may have to quit that office. Sometimes I have known of individuals who had to resign their jobs. But the biggest thing in the world is to be a Christian. The only thing in the world is to be godly and to be approved of God and to go to heaven when we die. And if we have to give up jobs, if we have to give up money, if we have to give up a fine home and move somewhere else, if we have to give up the A grade we want, or have to give up the social standing that we desire, or give up the honor that the school can give, or give up the approval of the teachers and everybody else concerned and be thought as a backward wallflower, a backward kind of a pick. What kind of a price is that to pay for heaven? There's not much to it, really. The world doesn't have anything that can begin to compare to heaven. And we've got to decide whether we want to go there or not, and if so, if we're willing to pay the price. Really, the price has been paid by Jesus. He's really paid the price. It's just a matter of our avoiding those things that can destroy our souls. By God's grace, it can be done. If we're willing to do it, we as parents must lead the way. Teach by word of mouth and by manner of life our boys and our girls what it means to be a real Christian. We can't expect them to make certain they are right regardless of the influences that are brought on them by their peers if they know we're compromising because of the influence of our peers. If we're not willing to stand up against those in our own peer group, we can't ask of them that they stand against their peer group. May God help us to realize we're all in this thing together, and we're going to have to lean on the Lord, stand for His truth, and be what He wants us to be if we ever reach glory. Well, as I say, I've just been talking for a little while. But I just hope that there's somebody here this morning who's not a Christian who will make up his mind or her mind that this is the time to be a Christian. Someone in the audience this morning who has been a Christian, but whose public example has been such that public correction needs to be made. Someone who will step forward to serve the Lord today. If there's one here, I think the duty and responsibility is plain, and what the Lord would have you do is well known. We'd urge you to do it. We stand and sing to encourage you.